CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 40, with Stephen Safran. Steve Safran is an amazing anterior segment surgeon specializing in the reoperation. Check it out. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today we have one of my favorite surgeons, Steve Safran from New Jersey here in the USA. And you've seen a lot of his videos. He's an absolute expert at the very tough reoperations. And we're going to talk all about that, his approach to this. Plus, I just love the way he thinks as a surgeon. And like he says, you should probably think before doing. But I don't always do that. Steve, welcome.
Hey, how are you, Uday? Good to see you. Thank you.
Yes, of course. I mean, we've all seen your videos where you really can do like the most difficult cases of reoperations, which is kind of no one's favorite because, gosh, the tissues are kind of unpredictable. How'd you get into being such an expert in reoperations?
Well, you know, I think a lot of this started off because of the approach I was taking. I was a big believer in taking a pars plana approach. I think that being able to work from behind and work from in front gave me a lot of ability to handle cases that, you know, typically fell in between where the retina people were, where the anterior segment surgeons were. On top of that, I do glaucoma, I do, you know, cornea transplant, I do a lot of lens exchange, complex cataract. And, you know, I get these cases where there's a crossover. I mean, most patients have more than one problem. They don't come to you, you know, with just one isolated problem. They have a dislocated lens, they have glaucoma, they have some cornea issue. So being able to handle all of these things as an individual, it just sort of snowballed and grew. And, you know, I tell people, you know, it's a bit like climbing a tree. You know, you climb one branch at a time. And then people say, well, how'd you get up there? And I say, well, you know, I didn't fly up here. You know, you just sort of one branch at a time get up there and you do something. Then you take that and advance it and do something else. And you take this idea. I learn a lot from the glaucoma people I talk to. I learn a lot from the retina people I talk to. And I kind of cross-pollinate and take ideas from different disciplines and put them together and handle that, you know, on my own. And I do like that. It's a lot of work, but I like it. It just sort of grew over the years where I decided not to shovel things away, just sort of take them on and handle them myself if I could.
Well, you know, a good question for you is, learning the retina stuff, and in particular, a three-port pars plana vitrectomy. So obviously I do cataract surgery, anterior segment surgery. I do plenty of glaucoma surgery. I've taught myself how to do like DSEC and DMEC and the corneal procedures. I do some iris reconstruction. I do all the above, but the one place where I don't think I have the skill set is a three-port pars plana vitrectomy, but yet you don't even think twice. It's just like natural to you.
Yeah, you know, it's not that it takes a lot of skill. It takes a certain level of comfort and familiarity, I think. You know, first of all, I did my cornea fellowship at Duke. That was back in 1991. And, you know, back then we had, you know, Mockamer, McEwen, Brooke Jean DeWan. I mean, these were giants in vitreoretinal. And they kind of took a liking to me. You know, like, I think they found me annoying in a pleasant way. And thought I had good ideas. And so they vitrectomy and had me do cases with them. And I'd be doing combined cases with them. They just let me take over and do them. So I felt pretty comfortable with the pars plana approach. What took some getting used to is learning how to use the biome, you know, the indirect visualization systems, because we didn't have those, you know, back in the early 90s at Duke. Those came out later on. So being able to adapt that, you know, in private practice, you know, I'm in solo private practice, and being able to adapt, learn how to work with something like that, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of an awkward thing if you never work with it. It's a bit like, you know, cutting your hair in the mirror where things are a little bit awkward, it's reversed. And once you get used to it and you get comfortable with it, you stop, you know, cutting your earlobes off and you feel more comfortable with it. So I've been, you know, growing with this. I mean, I do, you know, maybe four or five, sometimes more vitrectomies a week. I do a lot of these and it's, you know, pretty much since I came out in 91, 92 in private practice, just about every vitrectomy I've done has been through the pars plana. Most of them are three port and some of them are four port with chandelier lights. So, I mean, I just sort of grown with this. And, you know, a lot of the referrals I get for these cases are from regular people who, you know, they think I do a good job with it and I can handle all the inter-segment issues. So they just send it to me. Now, I don't do membrane peelings. I don't do, you know, buccals or, you know, retina detachment surgery. I mean, I try to stay within the limits of what I think I can do well. And what I try to do is use the pars plana approach to help me with dealing with anterior segment, you know, issues and problems. A lot of the times I see lenses that are dislocated, they're on the retina by the time I get them. Or I see, you know, cataracts that are bobbing around, and by the time I get them, they're hanging on, you know, in the vitreous or falling in the back of the eye. And, you know, these patients, a lot of them come from far away. You know, I don't want to cancel the patient because, you know, I've got a surprise on the table. I feel like I need to be able to, you know, just deal with that and handle it without having other people on call waiting for me to say, hey, you know, retina guy, I need your help over here. So I've just gotten very comfortable with this, and it really doesn't bother me at all to do these cases. I feel, in fact, I enjoy doing them. It's a sense of freedom because, you know, if you're in the anterior segment and you're doing something and you feel like, oh God, if I let go of this lens and it falls back, I'm hosed. You're very tight. You know, it's like you're walking on a tightrope. You know, everything you do is constricted, and it limits your ability to work freely. But if you're like, you know, hey, you know, that thing that falls back, I'll just go get it. You can do things in a better sequence. You know, you can clean up the vitreous before you start manipulating the lens. You can clean everything up. Summering's ring falls back, you go back and get it. And it gives me more freedom to do things the way I want to do it without focusing so much on worrying about something falling back. I can focus on, you know, doing a good job, cleaning everything up, making everything look right, not buzzing the iris with the retractor or whatever. And then, you know, if I have to go back, I always do go back anyway and clean up and do a complete vitrectomy. But if something's back there and I have to get it, it really doesn't bother me at all. Got used to it.
Well, as you said, though, you were very fortunate. You were at Duke where first vitrectomy was invented by Mockamer, the idea of vitrectomy. And then you got to work with not only Robert Mockamer, but you also got to work with Brooks McEwen and then also Gene DeWan. I mean, these are like the pillars of modern day retina. These guys are amazing.
Yeah, these guys were giants.
I mean, they still are, right? The two that are still around. But the question, though, is, you know, you did a cornea fellowship at Duke, and you're still able to have such great exposure to, you know, vitrectomy surgery. What about a guy like me? I didn't do that. How do I get my PPV skills up to speed?
Well, I mean, you know, this was like 30 years ago, and a lot of the instrumentation and things that we're using have changed. So I've had to learn a lot. And it's just like, you know, learning LASIK or learning how to do DSEC or DMAC. You know, you have to learn something new. I mean, you know, think of the guys who had to learn phaco, who were doing extracast. They had to learn phaco. I mean, that's their meat and potatoes. And then now they're doing a big, you know, jump into something totally new. That's like a sea change. So the first thing I would say is, you know, ask yourself, do you really want to do it? I mean, why do you want to do this? I mean, I think that most people who get in a rare trouble, you know, rare situation where they have an issue or a problem, are better off, you know, referring it, let it get fixed by somebody who's more comfortable than trying to, you know, be a hero and do something they're not comfortable with. And then if you're going to start doing dislocated lenses and your money and things like that, you have to ask yourself, well, why do I want to do this? How many of these cases am I going to do? Am I really going to get good at it?
Right.
So I think that, you know, this kind of a skill set, the whole, you know, pars plana vitrectomy, Imani, dislocated lens, lassoing, all of this stuff, you know, I think it's for people who really want to do this on a referral basis so that they have enough of these cases to really develop their skills. And they want to do enough volume and they want to get a reputation for doing them well. And get referrals for this so they have enough volume. Because you're not going to get the volume out of your own practice unless you're an awful surgeon. You get into trouble all the time. In which case, you probably shouldn't be doing this stuff anyway. You know, I mean, it's just probably not the best.
Well, you know, that's a great point. I mean, you obviously, for these complicated cases, it's going to be a referral-type practice. So you got to ask yourself, will you get all these referrals in? Because they're not going to be generated from your own practice. So in my situation, I do basically what you were saying, which is I have some great retina docs in the community and I enlist their help all the time. when I have a complicated case and I have that, you know, an IOL dangling in the vitreous, or I have the crystalline lens, like, you know, halfway in the mid vitreous. Well, yeah, I just can enlist their help and it makes life easier. So yeah, maybe you're right. I think for my situation, maybe I don't need to learn a three-part particle of vitrectomy. I'd rather just kind of hire that skill, if you will, with my colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it depends on, you know, what kind of cases you're seeing. I mean, if people are referring you dislocated lenses, that's a part of your practice, and you're accepting that and saying, I want to do this. Yeah, but I think you should learn these things. I think it can be done. And the way I would do it is, like you said, you're doing cases with your retina colleagues. Well, you know, have them, you know, sort of let you, you know, take over more and more of the case and sort of help you get through it. And, you know, you refer to them. And you can use that as sort of a carrot on a stick and, you know, say, hey, you know, look, I help you. I handle your complications. And I handle a lot of the retina guide complications. You know, they have a, you know, they put gas in the eye and there's a narrow, shallow chamber and they, you know, the cornea looks bad, the pressure's 50 or whatever. You know, they send it on over to Steve, you know. So, you know, it's a two-way street. And, you know, there's plenty to go around. Believe me, there's plenty of work to go around. So there, it's not like the retina guys are like, you know, hey, you know, maybe 30 years ago, 25 years ago, like, hey, what's this cowboy Saffron doing? You know what I mean? But now they're so busy, you know, they, they're like, you know, like, shoot, let him take care of that. We don't, they don't even want to do this stuff. They really don't. You know, some of them dabble in it, you know, and they start doing Yamani or whatever, and they say, damn, that's hard. You know, that lens tilted, I can't tell. Why does the cornea look the way it does? And they say, you know, I think I'm going to stick to injecting, you know, macular degeneration, because this is not really in their wheelhouse. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, like, you know, what's involved in the intersegment stuff that I do? You know, there's glaucoma, there's cornea issues, there's ocular surface issues, there's iris repair, there's handling IOLs, there's dealing with all of these things. Is it easier for a retina guy to get into all of that and handle that well? You know, incisions and astigmatism and all that. Was it easier for you and me to learn how to do a decent vitrectomy? Okay, that's an important question. It's easier for me to learn how to do a vitrectomy than all the other stuff. I'll tell you that right now.
For sure. That's a good point. In fact, I'm a little bit spoiled. Here in Los Angeles, the main retina people I refer to were all my residents about 10 or 15 years ago. So I taught them surgeries to hold their hands. And now, you know what? They can return the favor. They can teach me surgery and hold my hands.
Yeah, so they've been praying at the Temple of Uday for a while now, so they can time for them to make a sacrifice. You know what I'm saying? I think they'd be happy. I think they'd be honored to have the chance to work with you in that capacity. And if you're not good at it, they'd love to tease you about it, I'm sure. But I'll be honest with you. I used to do these cases with the retina guys like years ago. I mean, I would do it with the retina guys. And the retina guys would be fumbling with the IOL or fumbling with the paraplanar lensectomy because they're really not that good at handling IOLs. And they don't really know how to do phaco. You know, they'd be phacoing the vitreous. And they'd step on the pedal and the nucleus would go shooting off. And I'd be like, nah, you got to use low power, build the suction, get up. Can we switch? And I would switch and it would take me a little time to get comfortable, you know, because they would bring the lens up. They'd hit the iris and fall back. Bring the lens up, hit the iris and fall back. They didn't know how to transfer it in front of the iris because of small pupil or whatever. And so I would, you know, say, this has been good in like an hour farting around here. Can I try, really? And I would switch and they would be like, that was pretty good. You know, that was nice, you know? So the next time they say, why don't you just, you know, take over after I do this? And then the third time would be like, just do the case you know, sit over here. And they'd be like, you do the case. I'm not even going to scrub. Just call me if you need me. Then it's like, just don't even call me. Do it yourself, you know? So it did have sort of a progression where, you know, the dog got further and further off the leash. You know what I mean? And
Then they say, just call me if you have an entry site break. Then
I do so many of these cases. It's so rare that if I see a hole in the ret, like you'll be doing a vitrectomy and I do a, you know, pretty good vitrectomy and cleaning up in the periphery and everything by the trocars, you know, vitreous space. And I might see a retina hole or something and I'll take out the endo laser and I'll laser it. And I'll have them see the patient the next day, and they're
Nice.
fine with that. Now with the Optos too, you can see them, do an Optos the next day and see how everything looks, dilate them, everything looks pretty good. If I see anything I don't like, I send them to the retina people. But that's the thing. Like if you're doing a vitrectomy, right? Uday's doing a nice anterior vitrectomy, you're not using posterior visualization, you don't know if you have a hole or tear. You have no idea. But
Right.
I can do my vitrectomy with posterior visualization. I can see if there's a hole or a tear. I can see what's back there, and I can be aware of that, and I can laser it and refer it. And those patients don't get a macular off detachment because, I know what's going on. It's not a blind vitrectomy. The other thing I'm going to tell you is a couple of things. When I started doing, real vitrectomies instead of just, pars plana antivitrectomies, I can't tell you how many times I found that the eye was sort of a junkyard or a graveyard. There's all kinds of junk back there. I found IOLs, pieces of nucleus, some rings, ring material, all kinds of pro-inflammatory stuff back there. And when I started doing real vitrectomies, I realized some of these eyes, they don't dilate well. You go back there with the biome, you can see this and take care of it and clean it up, and patients' long-standing problems get better. The other thing I'll tell you is I had many situations patients refer to me bilateral multifocal misery. All right?
Okay.
Bilateral multifocal misery. One eye's been yagged, right? So we exchange the eye that hasn't been yagged first, right?
Okay.
Sure, easier. We exchange that. They say, this is great. Let's do the other eye. Okay, now I got to do a vitrectomy. So I do a real three-port vitrectomy. I clean out all the floaters, the vitreous, clean everything out. I opt to capture a new lens. 100% of the time, you know what they say to me? This eye's much better than the other eye. This eye's got all this clouds and swirly shit. When I say
Right.
that, when I say swirly shit
You can
on
say
this
whatever
thing,
you want.
that's good. All right. So it's got all this. They always want a vitrectomy in the other eye. Okay? They always want a vitrectomy in the other eye. Because the vitrectomy, this is how I learned how much of an optical role the vitreous has on the quality
Yes.
of vision. It's a
Yes.
huge issue. And the other thing is I used to do just two-port vitrectomies, pars plana vitrectomy, do lens exchange. The second eye, I would do a three-port vitrectomy. I had to go back and redo the vitrectomy on the first eye because I left, Weiss ring or some other junk. And they noticed the difference. They noticed the
Wow.
difference. So I've learned over the years that, you're better off really doing this a proper vitrectomy. And also, it gives you so much more control over the eye. That was how I kind of got into this. When I
Right.
would do cases with the retina guys at Duke, like I was doing the anterior segment cases with, Fowkes and Kobo, cornea guys, and we would do it a certain way. And then I would join the retina guys, and they'd have trocars in, and they'd have an infusion line in, and they'd ask me to suture in a lens. And I'm like, man, this infusion line, this pars plana
Game
infusion
changer.
line,
Game
this
changer.
is like, you just, this is great, man. This is like the safest feeling in the world. There's no hypotony, there's no bleeding. If there is any bleeding, you jack up the bottle. I mean, this is the most secure safe. I said, this is the way I got to do all my cases. And
Right.
so that's the way I did them. I started with, they were using these 20 gauge Alcon, the Grieshaber metal trocars. He made a ruby, diamond blade. He made a big 20 gauge, put the thing in. Well, it's not transconch, but it was a trocar. This was back in 91, 92. And I took the trocars, brought them with me, and that's how I did all my cases back in the 90s. And then came the disposable transconjunctival and the biome. And it's actually much easier now to do these kinds of cases, but you do need the instrumentation, and you do need to get comfortable with the instrumentation.
Right. That's all great points there. Yeah, there was a lecture I heard earlier this year in New York from a vitreoretinal surgeon explaining the refractive importance of the vitreous. And it's what you alluded to, how your patients who have the vitrectomy in the one eye prefer that eye to the eye that didn't have the vitrectomy.
Well, this is something I've been lecturing about actually for about 6 or 7 years. I actually have a talk called Vitreo Refractive. And first of all of the diffractive lenses, they have a very complex wavefront. I would say that the wavefront of a diffractive lens is like one of those architectural desserts. You go to fancy restaurants in LA, they bring you the Vertia table, and it looks like, this, Picasso, cello or something. It's a You stick your
Right.
fork in it, the whole thing falls apart. You know
Right,
what I
right.
mean? And that's how I think of the wavefront of these diffractive lenses. You know, they have all kinds of phasing patterns, constructive, destructive, interference. And, you know, all of that, you know, it's very complex. And any little thing that scatters light can take that whole thing. And instead of doing this, it now does this, and it doesn't jive, it doesn't work. Now, when you look at, you know, things like glistenings or calcifications or posterior capsule opacity, a dry eye or cornea guttata, anything that scatters light in the optical pathway, it's going to make a diffractive multifocal. Any of those patients go from happy to really miserable like that, you know.
But I like your word. I like your phrase. The patient has multifocal misery.
Multifocal misery. Yeah, but they could also have diffractive dysphoria too, you know. It could be an EDOF. And you know, but all these lenses, they have a complex wavefront that breaks down under stress of an optical right. system that scatters light. And the thing is that the vitreous is, you know, if it's turbid, if it's cloudy, it's not the floaters that they're paying attention to floating around. Those look like fly specks and annoying. They bother them. But some of these patients, the vitreous, it looks like somebody blew their nose in the eye. I mean, it's really turbid and cloudy. And, you know, it's true. Look, you know, looking through this stuff for the patient, it's constantly swimming past them. And, you know, right. I've learned to recognize the complaints patients have. Usually most doctors think this is dry eye because the patients say, yeah, there's cloud in my vision. And oh, it must be mucus in the tear film. No, it's the vitreous. And what I've learned is if you take your OCT, most OCTs have a scanning laser ophthalmoscope camera, right? You know, the SLO camera. Well, what I've learned to do is to use that camera to take movies of the macula. And you can see, when you do that, very easy to see the vitreous opacities floating past the macula. You got a patient look up and down, left and right, and you see this cloud floating past. It's like, you know, photo bobbing. You know what I mean? And so when I show that to patients, yeah, that's what I see. That's what I see. And so then we start talking about, well, you know, that's something we can help you with. We can remove that. But then, you know, the question is, you know, okay, so do we just do that? Do we exchange the lens? Do we do both together? Do we stage it? Which do we do first? Which do we do second? And, you know, a lot of my patients come from out of town and, you know, they just want everything taken care of at once. So most of the time I just take care of everything at once if I think that's going to benefit them. Right. Now, this is an important issue to keep in mind. The vitreous is not a useless blob of snot, all right? In young people, the vitreous has an important job, and that job is to deal with oxygen radicals, superoxide radicals, hyperactive oxygen species, okay? And that's why you do a vitrectomy and somebody gets a cataract right away, because the vitreous protects the lens from those superoxide, superoxide radicals, free radicals that oxidize the lens and damage it. Well, it's not just the lens that's affected. Other structures can be affected by these oxygen radicals. You get a higher incidence of glaucoma. You have a higher incidence of iris issues. You know, patients don't dilate well. It's not great for the eye to lose that shock absorber, that dampening effect on oxygen radicals. But here's the thing. A patient who has really snotty, cineretic, broken down vitreous, that vitreous has already lost the capacity to scavenge oxygen radicals. It shot its load. So when you remove this kind of snotty, crappy vitreous from people, it doesn't do much for that patient. But if you have a young patient who has formed vitreous, it's still got a collagen-like lattice, it's real vitreous. It's not water with junk floating around in it. Those young patients, if you say, well, I think I'll just get rid of that little floater they have, I'll take out their vitreous, you're doing them a potential disservice because they're going to have a higher risk. Obviously, they're going to get a cataract if they haven't already had one. They have a high risk of glaucoma. They have a high risk of zonular issues, iris issues. Right. You're putting the eye under stress. So the analogy I like to use is that, you know what a fusion of the neck is, right?
Sure.
You know, they fuse your vertebrae. I had that done a few years ago, a couple, you know, C5, 6-7. Well, if I take a young person, I fuse their neck, they're going to lose a lot of motility and mobility. They're going to lose a lot of movement. They're not going to be able to shake their head no and up and down the way they used to. But when I had my fusion, I didn't lose any motility because my neck was shot. What they took out wasn't working. It was done. It didn't do its job anymore. So it wasn't like it was moving anyway. All it was doing was hurting me. Okay. So when you remove vitreous, that a patient's already had that cataract. They've already had a retina detachment, whatever. You take out that snotty cinerotic vitreous, it's already shot its load. It is not doing its job anymore, scavenging free radicals. So you're not hurting that patient by taking that out. You're helping them optically. So I think this is an important, differentiation to make. You don't want to just willy-nilly be doing vitrectomies on people. Just like I'm not a huge fan of, clear lens extraction because I think I don't want my lens out. I like my lens, So, negative dystatopsia, positive dystatopsia, there's issues,
Of course. So
I don't feel that vitrectomy should be done willy-nilly. I operate on young kids with ectopia lentis. They have dislocated lenses. The lenses sit way over here. And if I can save their vitreous, that's, I think, really important. You get an 80-year-old, they have a dislocated lens, it's flapping in the breeze. I don't care if I do a vitrectomy. Right. It's not doing anything for them.
Yeah, it's totally different.
Yeah, totally different. I hope I haven't blabbed too much about that.
I love it. they're great points that I kind of really, we don't think about on a normal daily day basis. So one quick one I want to ask you, though, is about doing Yamane. So now we've been doing it for many, many years, and now we're starting to see, some big studies and some late-term sequelae. We're starting to see more patients get erosion. We're starting to see that, especially when an anterior segment does a Yamane, you get a higher incidence of CME. There's patients with vitreous traction, insufficient anterior vitrectomy done. And then also now I've got a video coming up on Cataract Coach later this month of the new lenses where the haptic is rotating in the haptic-optic junction and it's got a rotisserie effect.
Yeah, a couple of things. The haptic-optic rotation, I was actually the first one to report that. And I wrote a paper about that that was published in AJO last year with my son, Jordan, who's going into ophthalmology.
Awesome.
So we did publish that. And I spent a lot of time working with Zeiss on that. And, I'm not allowed to really say everything that, we know about it. But what I would say is that I feel that the problem is related to the optic has a hole drilled in it. And then they put the haptic in, they glue it in place. And sometimes there's a little void between the hole and the haptic. And aqueous, which is warm, gets in there. And I think it can kind of loosen that glue up a little bit. And if you combine that with the stress of doing the surgery, well, if I handed you a pickle jar and you couldn't get the top off, you'd heat it and tap on it, and then you'd unscrew it. And once it starts turning, it keeps turning. So
right.
I think what happens in these cases is that, you might have a lens that meets the criteria. It meets the designer's, the lens maker's specifications to put it in the bag. But it's not meeting anybody's specifications for doing Yamane, especially if you have a small pupil, you're torquing the lens, and it's one of those lenses that there's a little gap between the optic and the haptic. So you have that little gap between the optic and the haptic and the heat, the hot, warm aqueous gets in there, melts the glue a little bit, and you torque the lens and it reaches a point and the pickle jar starts to turn a bit. And these lenses will tilt. And they always seem to tilt on day one. It's always like a day one problem. Now, I think that some of this might be, related to the tunnel length and the technique. I've done hundreds of these. I've had three of these now. But the first two, I did not know the problem was a potential issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then I learned how to modify my technique a bit. And I didn't see one for a year. And then I saw one recently in a case. Most of the cases, I think, are small pupil cases. I think that there is a higher risk of this happening with more aggressive manipulation of the lens. And also, I think hypotony is a huge issue. So let's say you do the case and you do your Yamane. And, the patient's eye gets soft and the sclera collapse, that puts a tremendous torquing force on the lens. So the lens is then, the sclera collapses and it torques the haptics. And then the lens, it puts a lot of force on the haptics optic junction. So when I do these cases, I always make sure that my pressure is physiologic at the end of the case. When I remove the speculum, I make sure that, the eye gets soft when you take the speculum out. I firm it back up with the speculum out under the microscope, make sure the eye is firm, and make sure it's holding. If it's not holding, I'll suture my sclerotomy because I want to make sure that the pressure is physiologic and stays physiologic, because hypotony, I think, is a big issue for this. So that's one regarding what you mentioned about the haptic rotation. Regarding CME, yeah, I mean, it's critical to do a proper vitrectomy when you're doing any kind of sutured in, scleral fixated, intrascleral, any of these. It's critical to do a proper vitrectomy, because if you're in there and right. you haven't done a proper part of plane of vitrectomy, you're mucking around in vitreous behind the iris. That's going to cause vitreous traction. It's going to translate to the macula.
Right. A lot of cases that are sent into cataract coach, I get 30 to 50 videos sent to me a week. And so a lot of these videos of Yamane, it's an incomplete or very insufficient antivitrectomy. And then as they're doing the Yamane, we're seeing that IOL optic like halfway in the mid vitreous. So there's no question you're entangling the haptic and the optic in the vitreous.
Well, you know, you see me like writing into cataract coach saying, you know, this technique, blah, blah, blah. And I'm saying stuff and I'm biting my lip to say, don't. And I do it anyway. You know, the point is that if you're going to be working in the vitreous, you have to do a proper vitrectomy. If you're going to be behind the iris, you have to clean out the vitreous behind the iris. If you're manipulating and tugging on that, you're going to cause, I mean, just like vitreous to the wound causes CME, vitreous to the IOL, vitreous to other structures, you know, the eye moves, that's putting traction on, that causes CME. So I think it's critical to do a real aggressive, proper pars plana vitrectomy before you start mucking around and doing your Yamane procedure.
That begs the question. So do all Yamane patients deserve a proper three-part pars plana vitrectomy?
I think they all deserve a proper vitrectomy, yes. And they deserve it even if they've had a previous vitrectomy, because this is another big mistake. Patient had a fake vitrectomy, right? And then they have a cataract, the lens dislocates. Well, there's vitreous behind the lens.
Because right, the retina surgeon didn't want to shave too close to the crystal lens.
Taking all that. So you see these vitrectomized eyes, they've been done when they were patient with phakic, you know, then they get a cataract, then the cataract's done, and then the lens dislocates. Well, they got vitreous there, you know?
Right.
You got to remove that. So every single Yamane I do, I put in trocars. That's the first thing I do, even if the patient's vitrectomized. And you'd be surprised how much time, even vitrectomy is done by retina guy, in pseudo-fake patients, there's vitreous there, and you got to clean it up. And I think that has really reduced my personal CME rate. But the nature of the beast, when you start doing these complex eyes, is, you know, cystoid, you're going to see more CME in these kinds of cases. You're going to see more glaucoma. You're going to see more cornea issues, more ocular surface issues. It all comes with the territory of sick eyes. They, you know, eyes don't come with one problem. They come with a handful of them. And, you know, that's kind of how I got into doing this stuff.
So for a youngster who's starting off, I mean, you got to be very careful. If you're not doing a full part plane of vitrectomy, you need to do one of these more modern techniques of Yamane where you're not having that IOL and the haptics and the optic dangling in the mid vitreous.
I don't think there is a modern technique that you can avoid vitreous unless you've done a proper vitrectomy, because where are you putting your needles? You know, your needles are going, you know, through the behind the iris, they're going through. I mean, it's crazy.
No,
you can't avoid it. You can't avoid vitreous back there. You got to clean that up. And, you know, I see patients that lassoing lenses. You know, every time I lasso a lens, I pass the needle from behind through the arms of the haptics, through the bag. I do a vitrectomy, because otherwise you're just suturing vitreous to the lens bag complex.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. In fact, yeah, a lot of these patients now, you've seen videos online where someone will do a Yamane or a Lasser or whatever else, and the flanges are just sitting there right under the conjunctiva.
Yeah, I hate that. Let me tell you something. I really do not like this whole trend towards, you know, I don't want to say anyone's name, but, you know, that's been popularized by some people like, you know, Canabraba, McCabe, you know, belt loops and things like that. I really think that these patients, it's totally different than Yamane, Because with the Imani, you have the haptic, it's under tension, and you're pushing it into a tunnel. And it should be, if you do it properly, pretty much buried. At most, you might see
right.
a little tiny blue dot, you know, but it should be flush. These things are bobbing corks on the sclera. There's nothing holding them in place. A lot of the time, people are going straight in. The sclera is only less than a millimeter thick. They melt the thick proline flange, and it's just sitting there on the surface, bobbing up and down. And I think it's at high risk for eroding. It's at risk for, causing, foreign bodies. You know, I've seen these now on referral. We've seen that in ophthalmitis. So I'm not a big fan of, these bobbing corks on the surface of the eye. I really don't like it.
Yeah, I think you're right. You've got to make, you can't just go straight into perpendicular to the sclera, which is, like you said, less than a millimeter. You need to have that scleral
tunnel
length. And
right.
then you have to get the flange small and buried within the sclera.
Yeah, but who's doing that? You're not seeing people doing that. And even then, if they do it, it's not under tension to keep it there. There's nothing right. kind of holding it there. There's no reason. You know, when people blink, they're massaging the eye, and that thing's floating on the surface, And I see these, and people come into me, and I'm like, I gotta take that out.
Right.
They come out so easy.
When you can see the big flange, like you said, the bobbing cork sitting on top of the sclera, they all end up, I see them now later referred to me, where they're eroding through the conjunctiva.
Yeah, and you can't just cover them. My opinion, the best thing to do is just redo it. I mean, I take this stuff out, redo it, do it properly. Look, if you're going to take these patients back to the OR, my attitude is I want to do something to this patient where I never have to do it again. I want it to
right.
be one and done. And for me, I mean, I get a lot of ophthalmologists who come to me, the old guys with pseudo exfoliation who are still even practicing. And I always do it with make a scleral groove. I make sclerotomies, radial scleral groove. I made sclerotomies at the end of each groove. And the suture is inside the eye. The knot is rotated inside the eye.
Right,
okay.
Right.
And the suture itself lies under the surface of the eye. And you can't see it. And it can't erode. And it can't cause any problem for that patient. I think that time it takes for me to do that is a second. I mean, it's literally only seconds. The other advantage is that, it's much easier to control the tension, tie it and, control the tension by adjusting the knot when you're tying a knot and you can kind of tighten a little bit more and a little bit more than where you're melting, a proline flange. So, for me, if somebody in my family has a dislocated lens and where, we made the decision, okay, I'm not going to take this out. I'm not going to do Imani. I'm going to use this lens. I'm going to lasso it, the lens bag complex to the wall of the eye. Now, I'm thinking certain things. Is this a lens I want to keep? Is this a good lens? Or is this a lens that, damaged, it's all pitted from the ag laser, it's shot full of glistening, it's got subsurface nanoglistening, it's 80, it's the wrong power, it never was the right power. I don't know if it is the right power, the haptics are damaged. It's got all kinds of summerings, ring, inflammatory material in the bag. Where it's got a dead bag that's got no substance to it and it's going to dislocate. All of those, I'm going to get rid of the lens, okay?
Right.
But let's say it's a Goldilocks lens. One of those lenses that's just the right amount of fibrosis. It's got, no terrible summerings ring. It's a nice, clean, clear lens. It's the right power. Okay, then we can lasso the lens, And in those cases, I want it to be one and done. I want everything buried. I want it out of sight. I want to make sure the tension is right, that the lens is centered, and I want to do a proper vitrectomy. I want to do a proper vitrectomy because you're going to get rid of all this liberated crap that comes out of the bag. You're going to get rid of all the vitreous that might be tattooed to the lens bag complex,
right.
And you're not going to have any surprises the next day when you say, "How come the pupils peaked?" That happens.
Where do you stand on the debate between doing, let's say, Imani with a three-piece IOL of your design or using the Gore-Tex suture lens in place?
Well, it depends on what you mean. Do you mean like lassoing the bag versus taking out the lens bag complex? Or are you talking about like using Gore-Tex suture at CZ70 or something like that?
Yeah, let's say you refer to patient, aphakic, and the patient needs to have a lens placed. And I know you would not put an AC lens on that patient, ACIOL.
I never use them.
Talk about that too. But so would you do primary Yamane, or would you choose like a lens that has an eyelet and do Gore-Tex? Because now, you know, I have videos on CataCoach, what I've done with residents, where you can put intrascleral Gore-Tex. So there's no Gore-Tex on the surface of the eye.
Right. I like Yamane for a number of reasons. Number one, the incision size is smaller. It's obvious, you know, if you're going to use something like a, well, we're, you know, we're talking about something like a CZ70BD, which is
no, but you can also do like
an EVP.
There are also, you know, acrylic IOLs that come with eyelets, the foldable.
Yeah, let me talk about that. So number one, we talked about the Acryos. I don't like using hydrophilic acrylic lenses and complex eyes, really, in any eye. Now, the problem with the Invista is that the Invista, number one, the there are issues with the haptic holes fracturing, those eyelet holes fracturing.
Right.
That's been reported now. And I think we're going to be seeing more of those, you know, where the eyelet holes do, under tension, fracture. The potassium stuff, you grab the eyelet and the thing just slays open. I've got a video of that I can show you. And this has been reported now that these can fracture later on.
The Gore-Tex suture can like cheese wire through the material. The material is not as hard as you think it is.
No, because once it's sitting in the eye for a year or two, it softens it up and it pulls through pretty easily. And if you don't believe me, when you take out one of these lenses, when you take out an Invista, you'll see you just grab that haptic eyelet and it just falls apart. So I think that's a concern. I do. Number two, you know, the edges of these single piece acrylic lens are not forgiving. And if there's any tilt and the iris has any mobility and it hits the edge of that, you know, single piece acrylic lens or the haptic optic junction or any of that, I think there's a higher risk for an UGG syndrome. But I think if you can execute what you're talking about with Gore-Tex absolutely perfectly, you know, it's a good procedure. I just think Yamane for me is better. I mean, it's faster, it's easier. And I've done hundreds and hundreds of these and they are sitting there 5-6 years out and they look perfect. Like you cannot tell that they're Yamane and you don't even see anything, but if you look real careful, you might see a little tiny blue dot, you know? So I like Yamane personally. I like it more than, you know, suturing, you know, single piece acrylic lenses with Gore-Tex. You know, but I think people develop fastball techniques that they're comfortable with, and that's, you know, that's what they use. Now, I still do suture CZ70s now and then, you know, like if I'm doing an artificial iris, you know, and I'm, you know, I you know, I'm going to be making those holes anyway, and I want something super stable, you know, okay, yeah, then I'll just, you know, make a 7mm scleral tunnel. And you know, that's another art that I think people don't know. They have lost. I mean, now you and I trained with 5.5 round PMMA lenses. We were doing no stitch phaco, right? And making our scleral tunnels, our frown incisions. Right. Remember those days? That's a fantastic skill. I mean, I do ACIOLs. I take them out through a self-sealing temporal frown incision. I pop the, you know, Zeiss lens in or whatever three-piece lens in without folding it and just do Yamane and there's no sutures. You know, it's not really a big deal. It's not traumatic to the eye at all. I think incision size is overrated. I really do.
Well, especially when you do a beautiful scleral tunnel incision, those, as we've seen, even from the MSICS procedures, those are beautiful. And if you want to learn how to do those incisions, we got a lot of good videos about scleral incisions on cataractcoach.com, obviously. But I'm a fan as well.
I think that's an important skill. I mean, not so much for me. I don't do much M6 because I do, you know, I do parsplanal lendectomies and stuff like that. Right, I mean, I'll fake all these, you know, these lenses.
Like saying, to take out an AC lens, you're going to need a bigger incision, 6mm at least, 6.5. To put in the CZ70, for those who don't know, the CZ70BD is a 7mm optic PMA lens. So PMA is obviously rigid, non-foldable. And on the haptics, right in the center of each haptic, there's a little eyelet. So that's what we're talking about here. So for a lot of the younger ophthalmologists have never seen one.
And, you know, that lens is one of only two lenses in the United States market that has in the directions for use that it is okay for sulcus placement. It is a very forgiving lens in the sulcus.
What's the other one?
It's the LI61AO, the Bausch & Lomb three-piece silicone. That's a very forgiving lens in the sulcus, too. So, those are two lenses that are very gentle on the back of the iris. They don't cause UG syndrome too readily because they're approved for sulcus placement. And that's why I like, for piggyback lens, you put an LI618L. But what I'm saying is that the CZ70 is a very forgiving lens. When you suture it, if it's sitting a little too anterior, it won't cause an UG syndrome. But if you have a Yamani lens and it impinges on the iris, you will get an UG syndrome. If you have a single piece acrylic like the Invista, you will get an UG syndrome if it's tilted or sitting too anterior. So, I mean, I see these all the time. I see patients refer to me with UG syndrome, they're diagnosed with uveitis, neovascular glaucoma, you name it. And I can see the lens transilluminating through the iris. You can see the outline of the lens. It's like, a woman's leg when she's wearing a sheer dress, like you can see right through it, the light behind it. Like there's nothing covering that thing. And you can see these transillumination defects. Patient walks in and I say, "You got NUG syndrome." I mean, look, I transilluminate the iris. There's your lens. That's where it's hitting the iris. And, it can be missed for many, many years. You see all the pigment in the angle. You take it out, put the lens further back, put in a different lens, and you save them, from getting tube shunt, or maybe they've already had a tube shunt. You save them from having further damage. But, the point is that the CZ70, these techniques, I think it's important to have a range of skills and options that you can apply to have fastball techniques, yes, but to have a range of skills options and try to pick what you think is best for the patient that's going to solve their problem, not tomorrow, but in 10 years and in 20 years. And that's why I never like suturing to the iris. All right. I don't like, bobbing corks on the sclera. I don't like anything that I think I'm going to have to worry about. And the patient's going to come back to me saying, "Why did you do this instead of that when that works so well? And it works well. Why'd you do this?" Well, because that was the flavor of the month,
Well, you also don't like ACIOLs. We should talk about
Hate
that.
them. Hate them. I hate them because, number one, when they cause problems, they cause bad problems.
Right.
They cause iris damage, cornea damage, CME, glaucoma. I mean, all kinds of problems. That's number one. Number two, getting them out is a pain in the ass. They're fibrosed in the angle. They're stuck to the iris. The happiness are cocooned in. You have to dissect them out. It causes bleeding. You get psychodialysis clefts. You get iris iridodialysis. It's a real difficult thing. I would much rather pick a lens bag complex or a loose lens up off the retina and take that out, then take out an anterior chamber lens all day long. I mean, those
Yeah.
anterior chamber lenses are all socked in, they bleed. Sometimes they do you a favor. They were loose and bobbing around, you just pull them right out. Most of the time, it ain't like that. Most of the time, you gotta go with a gonio lens and dissect them out with, cutting the tunnel and pulling
Right.
out the haptic. And, you have to worry about dropping the haptic. It's one thing to drop a lens, I don't mind that. You drop a cut haptic on the retina, it's going to damage the retina. So you
Oh,
really don't
sharp.
want to, yeah, it's sharp. And then you try to pick it up. When you touch it, it's going to cut the retina. When I draw, when a lens is on the retina, you can just vacuum it up off the retina. You take an extrusion cannula, stuck it right up off the retina. You have something sharp that you have to grab. It's not, you can damage the
Got to put
retina
in
doing
PF,
that.
got to put in PFL and float it up.
Yeah, well, I'm not a retina guy. I don't really want to get into all that stuff. I'd rather, not drop that. I don't mind dropping an IOL, but I do mind dropping, like something sharp, or let's say an eye stent or something, or a Lugan ring or something. I don't want that falling back on the
No,
retina,
I agree with you.
so, because
Let's also
I don't really
agree.
get into that.
Let's agree also, you and I, that it is okay if a surgeon has a complicated case and there is vitreous prolapse and there's no capsular support. Instead of putting an AC lens in, it is okay to leave that patient aphakic and
It's
then
best.
refer to a colleague.
It's best. I get this kind of referral. I have fantastic surgeons who know the best thing for their, patient. I mean, I just had a patient refer to me, a prominent attorney from Washington, D.C. Guy who did the surgery, a fantastic surgeon, capsule radial tear spread, lens material. He cleaned it up a little bit, closed it up, sent it to me. I did a 3/4 vitrectomy, did Yamani. Guy comes back happy as clam, no problem.
Right.
You know, I didn't have to take out a lens. Sure. He didn't have to struggle to put a lens. I mean, the less you do, unless you're going to do a definitive, really top quality fix for somebody, the less you do, you know, just the better. Just, you know, get out of Dodge, feel good about it. Give somebody that you like a call. Doesn't have to be me. I mean, not like I'm making a living doing these kinds of cases. These are things you do for the community to help your colleagues more than to help yourself. I mean, you enjoy helping them, you enjoy helping the patient, and you feel like the cavalry. But it's not, you know, it's not a big, you're not making a lot of money doing these things. You do it because you like doing it and you can do it. And you have to be efficient at it. Otherwise, they can really bog you down. You know, they can take a long time.
Right, for sure.
You know?
These are long cases. You know, these are tough cases that are long.
Right. But I can tell you, honestly, I can take a patient with a lens bag sitting on the retina. I can do the vitrectomy, get that up, and do Yamani in about 35 to 40 minutes. Now, that's not a 10-minute cataract. But, you know, it's not going to kill me. That's not going to kill me. You know what I mean? I can do that case. I can do it myself. And I can combine it with the DSEC if I need to. I can even combine it with the tube, whatever needs to be done.
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not like an easy way to make a living, but it doesn't kill you like a 2-hour case. Now, you get a case, you got to do an anterior chamber lens and dissect that out. You know, in those cases can be, there's bleeding, you know, it can be
right.
They can take a long time, you know.
Of course. I tell patients, for very difficult cases, I tell the patients, please understand your surgery is going to take at least a week off of my life. I will give you my very best, but I need you to be really understanding and really appreciative because I'm doing you a heck of a favor.
Well, that's good that you have the confidence to say that, because I think it's important that sometimes they understand that. And I will often tell patients, look, you know, I won't be offended if you don't want me to fix it. Matter of fact, I'll be relieved. I'm offering to help you, and I'm doing it to help you. It's for you. It's not for me. You don't feel obligated. You know, if you don't want to do this, like I saw a guy today, he had like 7 or 8 surgeries. His iris is all chewed up. He's got a dislocated lens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sutured. It's stable. And, you know, he's got 7 diopters of astigmatism, you know.
Oh, boy.
Oh, my God. You know, so I'm like, you know, look, you're going to need, I think, an iris prosthesis, suture and lens. You're going to need this and that, you know. He said, well, you know, what if I just left it alone? I said, well, you'll be fine.
Great.
You'll stay the way you are. I say, you know what? You leave it alone. I will be one less thing I have to worry about, honestly. I'm happy to do this if you want to do it, but you ain't doing me no favors, okay? Because this is not... It's not a moneymaker, and it's not something I need to do, you know, to pay the rent. I want to help you if you want to be helped, but if you don't want to be helped, believe me, I'm not going to walk over you and change your golf swing, you know?
You're right. Of course. I think that's actually very important to get that understanding ahead of time for these patients so they know that, like, this is not a simple case. Listen, the cases you described, those – take time off your life. They really do. We talked earlier before we started recording how very often the night before surgery, I both will think about that challenging case that's scheduled for tomorrow. I'll go to bed at night, closing my eyes, thinking about, okay, this is this tough case I got tomorrow. What am I going to do? And kind of play it through my head. You do the same thing.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, sometimes I tell you, it's funny because you can think about a case over and over and over and over and think you have a plan, and it's so funny that the minute you sit down with the patient under the scope, your view of the case can change very, very suddenly, and you see things differently, and it changes your plan because you see an opening that you didn't see in your mind's eye the night before. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but that happens to me all the time.
Yes.
You know, you think you've got it all figured out, patient's on the table, you look down at the eye and you say, wait a minute. Yeah, and you think of a whole different way to approach it. And that happens very, very frequently. And, you know, usually that impression is the right impression because you're reacting in the moment instead of in your memory of the situation with the patient sitting up. You know, I just had a patient, you know, I had a ophthalmologist, okay? He's a young ophthalmologist. He's in his 30s. He came from a Middle Eastern country to see me. He had megalophthalmos, and he's a cornea surgeon. He does the same, you know, kinds of things that I do, you know, Yamani and DSEC and GMAC. And, you know, the other eye, he had a complicated surgery, and the lens just ended up on the retina, the cataract, and the retina guys had to take it out and suture lens in. And the eye that I came to me for, he's got a cataract. He's got megalophthalmos with iridonesis, phacoidonesis. He's got a huge eye, you know, lens. But, you know, there's no lens that's right. There's no right answer for him. No matter what you do, there's no right answer. Formulas don't work. You know, you know what I mean? I don't know if you're familiar how many megalophthalmocytes you've done, but they're no fun at all.
That case right there would take a year off my life. I don't know if I want to do that case.
It stressed me out a lot. I mean, it was the last case of the day, last week. You know, the guy is, you know, flown in for the surgery, and he's a young guy. And I mean, I don't know if what I decided to do was right or wrong. I think it was right. You know, I mean, he didn't dilate well, but, you know, what I did was I marked the cornea so I knew the Rexus size was correct. And I made a Rexus suitable for optic capture. And I did the phaco. And I put a CTR in the bag. And then I did a free optic capture of a three-piece lens. Because if you put the lens in the bag, it could dislocate in the bag. You can't put it in the sulcus.
The bag's too big.
Right. So I said, you know, I talked about it with him 50 times till Sunday. You know, well, what if we do this? What if we do that? What if we do this? What if we do that? And, you know, so he ends up, you know, he refracts to 20/20 on day one with minimal correction. He refracts, you know, but the lens is think about this. The lens is optic capture. It's optic in the bag, haptics in the sulcus. Huge bag, 5 tubes of viscoelastic in this case, right? So I see him day one. He looks perfect. Everything's great. He's like 20/30 uncorrected. He comes in day 5 because he's hanging around a little bit, which is yesterday, and he's myopic. He has a myopic shift. And I look at the bag, and the bag is concave, and the lens is sitting here. The bag, the posticaus back here, is capsule distension, okay? Because there was some viscoelastic in the bag, and now it's absorbed water, and it's pushing the optic.
So the optic is more anterior.
Right. So I'm looking at him, and I'm saying, you know, buddy, I said, we're going to have to pop a little hole in the posterior capsule, because if you build up any more pressure and it pushes the optic out of the bag, it's going to fall into the sulcus and dislocate.
Right.
I said, I want to put a pinhole
with the YAG.
I said, we got to put a little pinhole with the YAG. And I think it took me about an hour to talk the guy into letting me do this, you know, because he's like, well, but what if down the road I this and that? I said, dude, if I don't do this and you come in tomorrow and the lens is in the sulcus because it got pushed out, it's like a cork under pressure. It's going to pop out. So right. What I did was I scanned him and I found a little area where there was some space between the posterior capsule and the anterior hyoid. There was a little gap there. And so I put a little tiny pinhole right where that spot was. I have great pictures of it. And the viscoelastic went behind the capsule. The capsule came forward and the whole lens seeped back. And he ended up going from like minus a quarter, minus 150 to plus a half, minus 150, you know, at 180. So his refraction was fine. But what happened is that the pseudophacodenesis he had, because this guy's iris is like this, and the lens bag complex is like this, because that's the way megalophthalmos is. Well, the lens bag complex stabilized much, much more because it wasn't filled with all that viscoelastic anymore. So right. when the thing collapsed, it shrunk wrapped, closed up around the lens a bit, you know, it's much more stable. So, you know, now he's a lot more happy about that because it's, you know, it's much more stable. But the point is, you know, you spend so much time thinking about a case like this beforehand, afterwards, and the whole, you know, and there is no roadmap. There's no roadmap. There's only good logic and saying, look, no matter what happens, I feel that what we did was the right thing to do. You know, I have my reasons for doing it, you know. And, you know, the problem is when your patient's an ophthalmologist, you got to explain that, make sure you're on the same page and that he respects your thinking process on this, you know, because you don't want any recrimination.
Right.
I don't want anybody. Uday, I don't want anybody referring Megalodomus to me. Okay, so maybe we should just cut the whole matter. I've learned not to talk about anything you don't want referrals for. I used to talk about Demodex, like back in 2008, 9. I started treating Demodex. I thought, oh my God, there's these little critters in the island. This is the key to blepharitis. I started talking about. Well, all these people started sending these, patients to me, and I didn't want to be treating them. So I shut up about Demodex. Okay. Now, I don't want to talk about nanophthalmus because I hate nanophthalmus. I don't want to talk about megalophthalmus because I hate megalophthalmus. The two things I really hate are eyes that are too big to work on and too small to work on because they're really, really hard to work on.
Well, you're right, because like you said, none of the things apply anymore. Everything's different. The calculations are different. The tissues are different. It's an unknown. You go in there, and that's why I said that case takes a year off your life. Let me ask you a funny question though. For this tough case of the megalophthalmus eye, did you use a femtosecond laser?
I would no, I would never use a femtosecond laser because it's going to make that anterior capsule opening less likely. I mean, if that thing tears out, I mean, I would be really, really,
Right? Then you're
destroyed.
cooked. Then you're cooked.
You're cooked. And the thing is that with a megalophthalmus eye, that anterior capsule opening is like this, and the lens, it's like this. It's a tiny little.
It's
You
huge.
can't believe that's 5 millimeters. The lens is this big, and the eye is this big. You got this little tiny opening. So you're manipulating. You're getting out in the cortex and everything. You get a radial tear. It's game, set, match. You're totally hosed. And putting the CTR in this case, because think about this. The eye is so deep. This guy had a 5 millimeter AC depth, right? He's got a 27 millimeter eye. Got a 14
Wow.
millimeter white to white. So when I'm putting my CTR in, I'm angled down like this, right? I'm angled down. So
Right.
CTR did not want to feed. So I had to kind of drop it and let it feed by hand. Then when I dropped it was sitting on the anterior capsule. And it basically, part of it was still out of the bag. It looked like a radial tear. And I put in some iris retractors,
Oh.
and I could see that it was like on top of the anterior capsule like this. And I had to go with the micro forceps and feed it into the bag. You know what I'm saying? And then when it dropped in and the rexus was perfect, I was like, oh my God. Oh, thank you. I thought there was a radial tear. I did, because I saw this V. I'm like, oh God, there's a radial tear when I put the CTR in. So, I mean, if that had been a femto, I mean, I think there would be a much higher risk because that's a mini
A
perforation.
run
There's
out,
no
yeah,
radial
because
tear. Oh
the
God,
perforated stamp, like the perforated stamp edge of the capsulotomy, it's not really a rex, it's an otomy.
Right,
Those can
it's
run
a
out
post
easily.
example. Yeah, no, I
Yeah.
look, look, in 2011, when the femto came out, everybody was jumping on it and jumping, saying this is the next big thing, and that they needed somebody, would
But you,
debate
yeah.
these guys. And I said, yeah, I'll go up there and you can slap me around because I think this is ridiculous. And we would get paid $500, $600 for a cataract, and you want me to pay $500, $600 to make a rexus? I can make, why would I do that? I mean, no, you get not covered, you can't charge for it, and I don't need it, so why would I bother with this, So I said, yeah, I'll debate. And I went, and debated guys like Donenfeld and Steve Lane, people I really respect, Doug Koch. And
Sure.
I got into it with them because, I believed in what I was saying. I think I was right about this. And I still think I'm right about it. I think that, anything you can do by hand without complicating matters, and you can do that well, you don't need devices or machines to help you with. You're better off doing it as simple. It's like an iPhone. You have one little button on the front. That's all you need. That's better than having 500 buttons and more complications. I do a lot of complex cataracts, and the simpler I keep things, the less I have to worry about, the more I can control, the better it is. And the guys who do this stuff, Mike Snyder and Ike Ahmed, they all feel this. Dave Chang, they all feel the same way about this. None of them are using, lasers to
Right.
do these kinds of places. We rely on what we know we can trust.
Well, that's what I've
Right?
always loved about you. You're an absolute, you're a thinking man. And I love that, I love the way of the KISS, the KISS principle. Keep it simple, silly, right? So keep it as simple as possible. I'm with you there, but I've loved, loved, loved learning from you over the years. I kind of miss not seeing you on the podium more often. I got to get you plugged in more. And
I think some of the OEMs, they might not think I'm, manufacturer, industry.
It don't
friendly.
Matter. Ophthalmologists love you. That's what's more important. In fact, we're going to put a link down below for your YouTube channel. I'm a subscriber. I watch your YouTube videos all the time. I think you're an amazing surgeon. And I want to thank you for spending this last hour talking with us. And a reminder of viewers, we got a new podcast every single week with amazing guests like Steve Safran. And you can learn from his surgeries, but just let me warn you, he makes it look easy. It's not that easy. It's really hard.
Well, Uday, you make this look easy. I don't think there is anybody better at this, what you do in terms of presenting complex ideas and simple ideas to young people so they can learn how to do them. You make it entertaining. You make it simple to understand. You're self-effacing. You're funny. I think you're an absolute master at this, and I hope you keep doing it forever. I think you're great at it. And thank you, from the bottom of my heart, for having me here. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. All right, guys, my audience, I'll see you next week for another amazing podcast. Remember, we're on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find a podcast, plus on YouTube, plus on cataractcoach.com. Sign up for a daily email. Hey, follow me on Instagram, too.